Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is Dr. David Black. My guest today is Dr. Tanuj Dada, Professor of Ophthalmology and Head Physician of Glaucoma Services at the All Institute of Medical Sciences, New Delhi, India. He has authored over 300 research publications and has written 5 textbooks on glaucoma diagnosis and surgery. He is the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Current Glaucoma Practice. He serves on the World Health Organization Development Group for Glaucoma Interventions, and he has innovated several techniques of glaucoma surgery and also pioneered the research on mind-body medicine for glaucoma treatment. Welcome, Dr. Dada. You are a global expert in glaucoma. Let's open up. What is glaucoma? It seems so important. I mean, I'm terrified at the idea of vision loss, but so what is it generally from your perspective?
So glaucoma is currently the leading cause of irreversible blindness worldwide. So currently there are more than 80 million people in the world who suffer from glaucoma. And it's basically a disease of the optic nerve of the eye that processes the images and connects it to the brain. So in glaucoma, what happens that there is a gradual damage to the optic nerve of the eye due to various reasons such as high pressure in the eye, what we call as intraocular pressure, or decrease in blood supply to the eye, or various other causes that lead to optic neuropathy. So this is chronic slowly progressive disorder, and often there are no symptoms of the disease. So as the optic nerve progresses, the patient gradually loses the field of vision, and this can lead to blindness if not detected and treated in time. So it's basically a progressive optic neuropathy associated with optic nerve damage and visual field defects.
Yeah, and it seems like what I've been doing a little research online, there's an age element here. So, but is that always the case? It seems like 60 years and above are when you can detect some vision loss, and perhaps, and I'm going to guess here, and you can tell me if this is true, the patient shows up and is indicating signs that they're losing peripheral vision, or is this mostly by test early on that the physician is identifying that?
So glaucoma, in the early stage, there are no symptoms such that the patient gets a warning sign. So this is what we refer to as primary open angle glaucoma. And so it's recommended that after the age of 40 years, every 2 years, you get a complete eye examination done. And after the age of 60 years, annually, you get an eye examination done to detect eye problems such as glaucoma, because the symptoms only occur very late in the disease. So many patients who don't come for regular checkup, they often realize they have glaucoma when one eye is totally blind. And suddenly they realize that vision in one eye is very less and they are coping up with one eye. So they come at a very advanced stage. So that is why glaucoma is also called the silent thief of vision, because the vision deteriorates without any symptoms, patient don't know. And unless they come for regular eye exams, this disease is often not detected.
Wow, yeah, that point you make is kind of terrifying. That tells you something about our visual perception, right? Like these minor losses over time, imperceptible, and you may have one eye blind. Wow, that's pretty scary to me. And so you see this happen, the patient comes in, and at different stages, what do the treatments look like, the conventional treatments?
So the conventional treatment is basically, there are three modalities broadly of treatment. One is eye drops, what we call as ocular hypotensive medication. So you put in eye drops that lower the eye pressure. Second modality is lasers. So there are some laser therapy that we put laser spots in the eye and that reduces eye pressure. And thirdly, if both of these don't work, then we go in for glaucoma surgery.
So the first one, I have a family member who has glaucoma, and I do see them applying eye drops, and they do it multiple times a day. And this is an important part of the treatment, right? So,
yes.
How many times does a person usually have to do this? Is this lifelong? And what is the experience of patients that you see?
So the major problem in glaucoma is that whatever sight has been lost cannot be restored with any treatment. So whatever treatment you're giving, that is only to preserve whatever vision is left. So as soon as glaucoma is diagnosed and you start patient on eye drops, these are lifelong treatments. So patient has to put eye drop throughout his life. And often there are multiple eye drops. So there may be between 2 to 4 eye drops that the patient has to put in the eye. And that is a major problem for us because many of these eye drops have side effects. So your eye may become red. The skin around your eye may become pigmented. You may develop eyelash growth. You may develop irritation, watering, dry eye. So due to these side effects, many of the patients often just stop the medications. And the second issue in developing countries is that these eye drops are quite expensive. So many of the patients are not able to afford the eye drops. So even though you prescribe the patient eye drops, due to economic reasons, the patient just stops putting the eye drops. So these are the two major challenges that we face. And in developing countries, 75 to 90% of glaucoma is undiagnosed. So that is another major challenge. And that is why it's very important to popularize this glaucoma screening. Even if you don't have any problem, when you start going beyond the age of 40 and you go for your first spectacles for reading, so that is a time when you must get your complete eye evaluation done to pick up any eye disorder such as glaucoma.
Yeah, you make up a really important point here. The economic impact that may be differential in developing nations. For nations that have differential access to care, even within what you might say developed nations. And then what about the impact also on the family? Many patients might still be of working age. And is this affecting work life and family life?
Yeah, definitely it affects work life. And in fact, the major problem occurs that if you get a visual field defect or advanced disease, then you are more prone to motor vehicle accidents. So if your disease is moderate or advanced, then you have to stop driving because you can be the cause for motor vehicle accidents. And then once you get visual field defects, especially elderly population, they're more prone to falls. So because they don't see objects on the ground, they can trip and fall. And that is also a risk factor for the fracture of the hip femur. So those are some challenges that glaucoma patients face, and many of them have to give up their jobs because once the vision goes down and they come at a late stage, whatever occupation they were doing, they can't carry on that occupation, and many of them have to leave their job because of the disease. So that leads to a lot of economic problems for the patient family, and that also leads toward and something we call as caregiver burden. So you have the caregivers, and when they are dealing with a patient who has advanced glaucoma or who has blindness from glaucoma, so that leads to caregiver burden, and that leads to a lot of anxiety, stress in the family.
Yeah, I mean, well stated. I didn't even think about the hip injuries from falls. And is it also a decision from like your Department of Motor Vehicles that once there's a diagnosis, that they're actually, I know we have restrictions on driver's license based on vision. Is it similar? So it's be organized. They wouldn't be able to go to work in that way.
Yeah. So once patient gets advanced glaucoma with both eyes damaged and visual field defects, then we counsel the patient to use a public transport or something like a Uber service or ask his relatives to drop him off. Because that time he's at risk to other people because he's driving. He doesn't see people or cars coming from either side. So that is a very risky scenario.
And you, the second treatment, so the first treatment, very challenging. And I totally see that. I see it in real life in my family. It's, you know, to keep this up, I'm always amazed about the dedication it takes to keep the eye drops going. You also mentioned these laser procedures. What is, broadly, what is that like? What's the technique?
So glaucoma is of two types. One is called angle closure glaucoma. That is more common in India, China, Asian countries, and Eskimos. So in that, the primary treatment is a, what is known as a laser iridotomy. So you just make a small hole in the iris with laser, and that can prevent disease progression when if caught in an early stage. But the glaucoma we are discussing today, what is more common in America and Europe, is called open angle glaucoma. And for that, we have a special laser. It's called selective laser trabeculoplasty. So basically, the drainage system of the eye is known as the trabecular meshwork. That is like a sieve. It drains the fluid, the aqueous, from the eye to outside the eye. So this is applied, laser is applied onto the trabecular meshwork to basically open up the meshwork and increase the outflow of aqueous. So for this laser treatment for open angle glaucoma is known as laser trabeculoplasty. So that is an alternative or addition to putting eye drops.
And when does that usually happen? Is this is in advanced cases, or they're taking eye drops and the eye drops are not seeming to work? What's the timing to do this?
So this can be taken as a primary therapy. So if patient comes with a high pressure or early glaucoma, he's given a choice whether he wants to put eye drops, or if he doesn't want to put eye drops, then he can be straight away started with the laser trabeculoplasty. And recent trials have shown that it gives a very good response. So if the patient doesn't want to use eye drops and the glaucoma is at early stage, then straight away he can be given this option of a laser trabeculoplasty, what we call as SLT, selective laser trabeculoplasty.
And it seems all of the mechanisms at work here, or the primary mechanism at work, is the reduction of intraocular pressure, right? Because that's the identified major risk factor of glaucoma. From what I've seen, it's the only therapeutic approach that we are aware of, right? Is that a correct statement? And so everything is targeting that.
So theoretically, we have three or four mechanisms. Like, one is you reduce trauma to the optic nerve, barotrauma. That is by reducing eye pressure. This is the only commercially available modality. The other modalities which are not commercially available but under scientific research are to increase the blood flow to the optic nerve. And third one is what is known as neuroprotection, that you provide some neurotrophic factors to the optic nerve to prevent the ganglion cells from dying, or the neurons of the optic nerve from dying. So you give some nutrition to the optic nerve. So that is known as neuroprotection. But these are under research. So currently, the only therapy available is to reduce pressure, either with drops, either with laser, or with surgery.
And you have argued for addressing perhaps the role of stress in human stress, psychological stress, physiological stress, various types of stress definitions there, and its role in intraocular pressure. So do you want to talk about that link? This is kind of a theoretical model you've been working on and presenting in some of your papers. What's that link, and why should we be interested in it?
Okay. So I think this is a very valid question. So, like, if you have a bad boss under whom you're working, you are likely to have stress and you go into systemic hypertension. Okay, so you're having a bad time in your workplace over a long time. You will have chronic stress and your blood pressure will go up. So you can get hypertension. So this is, everyone is aware of this connection. Chronic stress leading to systemic hypertension, elevated blood pressure, which increases risk of cardiovascular disease and cardiac events. So similarly, when you have stress in any situation, psychological stress in your life or any other cause of stress, So what happens? It raises levels of stress hormone that is called endogenous cortisol. And that is very dangerous for glaucoma patients because glaucoma patients are already steroid responders. So whenever a glaucoma patient comes to us, we ask the patient some leading questions. And most important is, are you taking any form of steroids? So any patient, when you take a history of a glaucoma patient, you ask the patient oral steroids, injectable steroids, eye drop steroids, nasal inhalers, asthma inhalers, all these, any exogenous steroid raises the pressure of the eye. However, what we have been missing is, what about the steroid within the body? That is cortisol. So if the cortisol rises within the body and you have a glaucoma patient who is a high responder, so high responder means that if a normal person gets steroids, his intraocular pressure may not go very high. But if you give a glaucoma patient steroids, the pressure goes very high in a short period of time. That is called as high responder. So glaucoma patient, if they undergo psychological stress, and that is very common because it's a blinding disorder. The moment you tell the patient you have glaucoma, his family and his stress is very high because there's a danger of getting blind. So that stress elevates cortisol, and cortisol over a period of time can lead to rise in intraocular pressure. And that is something we have been ignoring till now, totally. This association has been ignored. And I'll give a small anecdote. So I had this friend who was a lawyer, and he used to come for his daughter's checkup, and maybe once or twice in a year, he used to say, "Please do my checkup." And he used to be always normal, 16, 18 pressure, everything normal. Then one fine day, he came with his daughter for checkup, and his pressure was 28 and 30 millimeters of mercury. And I was very surprised, and he was also very surprised. And then I was just talking to him. So he said he's going through a very important litigation case, and he's not been able to sleep properly, and he's under a lot of stress. So that suddenly gave me like a eureka moment that this is definitely something we have been missing. And many times I have seen in my practice that patients are well controlled, and suddenly they come with a high pressure. But we have never asked them this question, that was there any psychological stress in the recent times? So that made me realize that definitely there is a link. And in fact, because I have been a meditator since I was a college student, and so I had no embarrassment in counseling that my friend that you try for some time just mindful breathing, relaxation, meditation. And then he came back after 3 weeks, and pressure was back to 16, 18. So that really set me onto this research on this topic, that stress, cortisol, and glaucoma, they may be something we are missing, and made me start this research. And the second important issue is that there is a subset of glaucoma known as normal pressure glaucoma. There, the intraocular pressure is not elevated. The problem is that you have a decreased blood supply to the optic nerve due to a vasospasm. That vasospasm is directly linked to stress and to autonomic dysfunction. So if you have stress, you have a sympathetic overdrive. You have release of catecholamines. They lead to vasoconstriction. They constrict the blood vessels, and that decreases the blood supply to all major end organs, including the eye. And that can also lead to optic nerve damage. And that is especially important in elderly people or people who have other disorders such as cardiovascular disorders, hypertension, diabetes. They already have autonomic dysfunction. So, and there is no treatment. I told you there is no pharmacological treatment to correct autonomic dysfunction. But with mind-body medicine and practices such as mindful meditation, you can regulate the autonomic dysfunction, you can reduce the sympathetic drive, and improve the blood supply to the brain and the optic nerve. So that is a very important benefit of this mind-body medicine that is not available with any pharmacological drug. And the third important factor, what we were discussing, is neurotrophins. So there is no vitamin or neurotrophin which has been commercially proven to be useful for glaucoma. And this is multi-billion dollar industry. They're trying to produce neurotrophic drug for the eye, optic nerve. Till now, nothing is successful. But when you do meditation, what is upregulated? You are upregulating brain-derived neurotrophic factors and you are upregulating endorphins. And both of these are endogenous neurotrophins for the brain and the optic nerve. So while modern science concentrates on $1 billion research and drug industry to produce these drugs, Mother Nature has given in the human body an innate precious pharmacy, which can be released through the process of meditation for great benefit to the human body. And like you have a car engine which controls the entire car, similarly, the human brain controls the entire body. So if you harness the power of the human brain through meditation, it can lead to a cascading of a very good effects, not only for the eye, but for the entire human body.
Yeah, thank you
so
for that.
That has
That's
been
very
the basis
thoughtful.
Of our research.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking me through that mechanism and showing us the way you're thinking about that. It's very thoughtful. And you in particular, so you've been pioneering in the glaucoma world with several trials that you've been working on, targeting intraocular pressure as well as other outcomes of the eye. And you in particular, the meditation program you are using is the Structured Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program that
yes.
I've studied myself and that many people in the States here have studied in clinical trials. So the selection of that program, where did that become of interest for you and why the selection of that program?
So meditation basically is of two broad categories. One is focus attention meditation and one is open monitoring meditation. So focus attention meditation is you focus your attention either on a sound or on a mantra or on your breath. So out of these, we chose the breath. And there is a very important reason why we did that. If you see the studies done on breathing in modern physiology, when you do slow breathing from the nose, less than 6 breaths per minute, the nasal mucosa has one of the highest innervations in the human body. So the nasal mucosa innervation is connected to the olfactory lobe. And that directly connects to the hypothalamus. So when you do slow breathing, less than 6 breaths per minute, like you do in mindful meditation, focus on breathing, you are directly changing the tone of the autonomic nervous system. So you are upregulating the parasympathetic nervous system and downregulating the sympathetic nervous system. So that in itself is very useful for the human body, especially because we are trying to downregulate stress and the sympathetic nervous system discharge. So that is why we chose mindfulness meditation, focus on breathing. And the second thing was this is universally applicable. So supposing I make you meditate on a mantra from the Vedic literature, that may not be acceptable to other parts of the world. And a sound also may not be equally acceptable, but because it's our own breath, focusing on that is the easiest thing. And that is available to you throughout the day, wherever you are traveling anytime. So because of its physiological benefit and applicability to all age groups, all ethnic classes, all religions, we chose this particular strategy for glaucoma patients.
How was it received? Because it is interesting, the context of MBSR, its history we won't get into here, but then has been kind of structured in a Western type format where curriculum makes sense to the Western mind. And so you have a series of sessions and they kind of build on each other over time. In contrast to what you were saying about other techniques were probably just as valid, but fit within a cultural milieu, right? And
yes.
So it's almost like a reach then back. It's like, okay, now we'll borrow this because this is a structured method that doesn't matter what culture you are in, which belief system you have, it is digestible and interpretable. And so the breathing elements, like you're saying, within that program is important. But what about the language? Because that's the second piece of something like a secular MBSR program, where people, there's a language and the way you think about the mind. Is that culturally appropriate, relevant, and how is it received?
So actually in India, we are very lucky because most of the people are aware of meditation, yoga. So they know this is something good for you. And they also have a more of a spiritual bent. So they feel this is a form of prayer to the universal consciousness or what we call God. So the acceptance is very high. And the patients do it as a sort of prayer that they close their eyes and they focus on their breathing. And our instruction is in both English as well as our Hindi language, but most of the patients understand English. So the instruction is quite simple because you're just focusing on breathing with eyes closed and focusing between your eyebrows. And in general, the patient should have a feeling of well-being that he's going to get better with this sort of activity and have an optimistic viewpoint. And why the acceptance is very high? Because we have taken patients with moderate to advanced glaucoma. And often they are at the brink of surgery. So if their glaucoma is not controlled, they are already on multiple medications. Then the next step for them is to go into the operation theater. And glaucoma surgery for a patient of advanced glaucoma is not a simple surgery. There are sight-threatening complications inherent in the procedure. Most of the patients are likely to get some deterioration of their vision. So because of that surgical scare, many patients are really motivated to do a trial of this meditation before they subject themselves to the knife. So that is, I feel, very motivating for patients who are moderate to advanced glaucoma because there is no other option available for them. They have had laser, they have had drops, they await surgery. So that is why the acceptance I found is quite high because of the scare and it's a blinding disorder. So they definitely are willing to try it out.
And I think one of your trials, so you have a series of trials, one of them, and I think in a couple of them, you show a reduction in intraocular pressure associated with either mindfulness training broadly or mindfulness-based stress reduction. And one, you reported, if you add this as an adjunct, there could be the avoidance of surgeries. Now, do you want to talk about that one?
Yes.
Is it that there's relief and the patients have decided that they may be okay as is with management, or was there something else?
So this was a trial published in the American Journal of Ophthalmology. So we had the patients in two groups. They were all patients for advanced glaucoma waiting for surgery. So one group was waitlisted, and other group underwent meditation. So out of the 30 patients with advanced glaucoma who were waiting for surgery, half of them, 15 of them, the intraocular pressure dropped drastically and it reached a target intraocular pressure. What is the ideal pressure for the optic nerve? So those patients, they were putting eye drops, the pressure was very high. After meditation, the intraocular pressure dropped drastically. And because of that, they were not subject to surgery, so they could avoid getting glaucoma surgery done because they were doing regular meditation. However, half of the patients, despite putting medications and doing meditation, intraocular pressure did not reach a very low level and they were subject to surgery. So we found that if the patient does meditation very regularly, half of them could avoid getting surgery done. So that was very amazing for us also. We didn't expect this to happen. But the caveat is that you have to do it on a regular basis. So we have some patients, after the COVID breakdown, we stopped our programs for meditation and all. And then some of the patients stopped doing meditation. And when they came back to us now, after the opening of the lockdown, the pressure is again high. And we asked them, they said, sorry, we stopped doing all this meditation. We were in the COVID and all. And then pressure again went high. So the important thing is that if you do it as a regular practice, then you can definitely control the pressure and you can avoid surgery. But it's a lifetime practice. It's not that you do for a few days and you leave it. That doesn't work.
So a couple points are coming to mind. One, that given the intensity of the surgical experience and the potential for negative outcomes, so additional vision loss, that looking at something like meditation before doing that is a good idea, because there is a percentage, not all, but some of that group, for whatever reason, are going to be sensitive and responsive. To meditation, and some won't. So you would probably want to group them, those up first, find them. And then the second piece, because then the others would have to, of course, carry through, because they do need additional intervention. Yeah. And perhaps this first group also needs it at a later time, but at least it's delayed. And then the second piece is that for those that are sensitive, there needs to be the motivational element and the supportive element, and perhaps groups at our healthcare centers and the community that would aid individuals to carry this on, because then they have to actually do the practice. Yeah. And it actually brings up something interesting to mind, because you're asking them to adhere to something anyway, which is daily drops. And then because people see that as a clinical feature, they might be more likely to adhere versus, oh, meditation, it helps, but it doesn't have that clinical flavor. Is that a truism about the way patients respond? Or do they also just kind of give up on, I can't remember if you said they often might give up on the drops too.
So I think patients don't give up on drops so easily. I told you the reasons. One is economic reasons. They can't afford the drops.
Yes.
And some of them have side effects due to the drops. So then they stop the drugs. But in general, if you explain the disease, explain to the patient the importance of these drops to prevent blindness, they carry on the drops. Now, the other important thing is that why meditation is important, because the patient's quality of life is already bad due to glaucoma, and glaucoma treatment worsens the quality of life. So all these drops have side effects. Surgery has side effect, laser has side effect. So often the treatment is worse than the disease itself. So when you put in mind-body interventions like meditation, irrespective of whether the pressure falls or no other effects, the patient feels very optimistic and nice. So you have the same patient who came before meditation that he was quite sad, anxiety, depression, feeling bad in life about general. And then he comes after 6 weeks of meditation, he has this new vigor, he's bubbling, he's happy. He's able to cope with disease better. And even though he has a disease, he's no longer afraid of blindness. So he has the quality of life, the mental perception changes. And that is itself a very important thing, because to make a patient happy is the end goal of a physician. So forget about whether IOP is there or no, or other effects are there. The quality of life improves. And there is no therapy in glaucoma to improve quality of life. As I told you, all therapies worsen quality of life to some extent. So that is why meditation is very important, to help patient cope up with this blinding disorder and improve his mood, anxiety, depression, all these effects of the disease on the brain.
Yeah, and I've appreciated that in most of the work, in most of your trials that you looked at MBSR and people with glaucoma of various types, quality of life was always an indicator.
Yes.
Do you want to give a snapshot about overall from your work, what's the outcome on quality of life when you give your patients mindfulness training intervention?
So when the patient goes through 4 to 6 weeks training for mindful meditation and does it regularly, so the first impact is on the quality of life. The patient who was previously having anxiety, depression, fear of blindness, all those go away. So the mood of the patient improves. You get a happy patient who listens better to you, understands the disease better, and he's in a positive mindset that he'll be able to fight the disease throughout his lifetime. And another important thing is once the patient starts meditating, there is like this positive addiction. He feels so nice after a few days that he continues that as a habit for the future. It's like exercise. When you do exercise on a regular basis, you release endorphins and you have a feel-good factor. And if you don't do exercise, you don't feel nice. So the similar thing is true about meditation. One, it's a difficulty is to start. If you start on a regular basis, it gives you such a feeling of well-being. And if you don't do, you miss that. So that becomes a very important part of your day. So you continue with positive motivation. And the other important thing to understand is that these are elderly patients. Many of them have other associated diseases. You have high majority of patients having systemic hypertension, cardiovascular disease, cerebral vascular disease, migraine, all sorts of physical or psychological disorders. And meditation has been proven to be a useful adjunct for all these disorders. So leave apart the eye. If patient has got cardiovascular disorder, he benefits from meditation. It reduces risk of mortality. If he has anxiety, depression, psychological disorder, that improves. If he has systemic hypertension, the blood pressure falls. If he has any chronic pain-producing condition, arthritis, that improves. So not only with one intervention, you're targeting the eye or glaucoma, you are in fact, we label this as a polypill because it is targeting multiple systemic diseases with one intervention. So overall health improves. And that is very good. And lastly, whatever you do, you cannot prevent aging. So over time, the only organ that you want to retain is your brain. Over time, you get degeneration of the brain. Till date, modern science has not produced any drug to arrest aging of the human brain. But do you know, lot of studies on meditation with neuroimaging, with MRI studies have shown that meditation prevents neurodegeneration. It can arrest aging of the human brain. It can lead to gray matter and white matter synthesis in the adult brain. And the brain of long-term meditators, the brain age is much less as compared to age-matched population. So here you have an intervention which is actually showing neuroprotection to the human brain, which has not been possible with any modern pharmacological therapy. And this is now widely published. The first study was by Sarah Lazar from Harvard Medical School on the effect of meditation on the neurogenesis in the adult brain. So that is a very exciting area because in all these neurodegenerative conditions, the brain is degenerating at a fast pace and you're not doing anything to prevent that. So meditation has turned out to be a key intervention that can delay human brain neurodegeneration.
Very well thought out. And in your own work to address those biological features, you showed that there was a reduction in heart rate, systolic and diastolic blood pressure after your study. So you showed that pathway. And now you're indicating another pathway. And so does that inform your future work? If we're thinking about ideas that have been or questions unresolved for you that you're still excited about, where do you think you're going with this after several trials?
So what we are trying to now do is to do, these are short-term studies which have proven that this is a concept worth investigating. There is no cost involved. Only the patient has to give in time. So the first challenge is to convince the patient to give a time. So to give 1 hour of your life is quite significant. So we're trying to do studies now with half an hour of intervention, whether we can get the same effect with just half an hour of meditation. Although I would advise all viewers that 1 hour of meditation is really good, because your brain is so wired to the world that it takes some time to shut it down, to slow down your thoughts. So it's not such an easy exercise. It looks very easy to close your eyes and meditate. It's the most difficult thing to do till you start off. So I have had a lot of patients who are like very educated in professions, and you ask them that, could you do this? So they say, yes, we did it for 2 minutes. We did it for 5 minutes. We can't do beyond that. I can't sit still for more than 2 to 5 minutes. So that is a major challenge we face in the modern world, to make a busy office goer sit for more than 5 minutes. So that is a challenge. The second issue is that we want to do long-term studies with imaging of the brain, and to show whether over time we can have reversal of the visual field defects. So we are showing short-term results, but do the retinal ganglion cells regenerate, or do they pick up a new activity over time? Can you reverse the visual field defects? That is the area for future research. And MRI imagings we are doing, but that is a significant challenge, because there is some claustrophobia. The patients doing meditation under the closed MRI is a great challenge, because I have myself tried that. The amount of background noise during the MRI, that really disrupts any sort of meditation during that process. So that challenge we have not been able to overcome till now. But future studies we are planning on EEG, like you do a full EEG of the human brain and ask the patient to meditate. Then we are also doing studies on brain oxygenation to see how the oxygenation of the brain increases during meditation. And then, of course, long-term studies on the visual function of the optic nerve, the perimetry visual field. And we're also studying now the effect of meditation on the sympathetic nervous system by evaluating the catecholamines, how they change over time with meditation. Because that is another thing, like cortisol, stress hormone. The second important thing is catecholamines. That also worsens the vascular disorder and causes decreased blood supply to the optic nerve.
So big questions to answer. It sounds like a fun journey ahead for you.
Yes.
Some simple questions just about the behavior itself. I've become interested in what we do when we're meditating, because we do some things that are so simple, they might seem mundane, but there might be physiological consequence. So let's say with focused meditation on the breath, we typically have our eyes closed, or at least almost closed. Now, is there is there a simple physiological relief in the eye when we are just using our eyes less intensely? Because I'm imagining, for example, modern life and staring at our phones. And I know that I get eye fatigue. I don't know if this is related at all, but meditation itself just allowing us to rest our eyes in a different way. Is there any implication there, or is it too simple to think that way?
No, that is very important, because most of us are hooked to our mobile phone or the laptop. And even if you close your eye for 5 minutes and do mindful breathing, that is very helpful for relieving the stress of accommodation on the eye. And it also, during your staring on the laptop, you also get something known as computer vision syndrome. There's evaporation of the tear film that causes symptoms. So you benefit by closing the eyes. And thirdly, even for short time, when you do this slow breathing, there is one technique which is published in Scientific American. This was an article in 2019. Proper breathing brings better health. This is known as 365 breathing. So 3 times a day, you reduce your breathing frequency to less than 6 breaths per minute for 5 minutes. So this small 5 minute exercises of slow breathing fine tunes, changes your autonomic nervous system and produces a relaxation. So this simple activity is very useful, not only for the eyes in general, but also for your entire body by reducing the sympathetic over discharge.
So it's simple. It seems so simple. The challenge is remembering, right? The memory of the day and the long-term engagement. Because we all know, yeah. I think most of us know, like, oh, I do want to do my daily breathing. But then that idea fades into the cosmos.
Actually, the problem is that we are taught how to tackle disease. But the issue is, you have to focus on positive health so that you don't get disease in the first place.
That's very well put. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your interest in this topic, your work, and the fact that you're out there trying to help patients, both in clinical world, but improving their quality of life. What a wonderful job you're doing out there. Thank you so much. Find our podcast recordings at goarmra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member or subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.